This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Patreon supporters. Thanks, guys! Patreon supporters get after-show episodes, bonus book reviews, and more, so consider becoming a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the episode.
The mentality becomes less like, oh, we're doing this for, you know, the freedom of Afghanistan. We're doing it for each other. You know, this band of brothers mentality.
Leavenworth is where Clint Lawrence is doing 19 years for murder after a 2012, quote, incident in Afghanistan that left three locals dead. Leavenworth is also a five-part series on Starz, exec produced by Steven Soderbergh, on everything surrounding that incident, and there is really a lot of everything. And get out those Alcatraz triathlon t-shirts, because our cold case topic is Criminal's 2017 episode on the maybe great escape. Dig, dash, dive into The Blotter Presents, episode 117. Those t-shirts do exist. I really regret not keeping mine. I got it as part of a promotion at the mall store I worked at. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Unlike that story I just told, I am joined again today by dummy head connoisseur Jeb Lund. Hello, Jeb.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
Thank you so much for coming back. All right, let's get into our most wanted section. Starz' five-part documentary, do this podcast much, series, Leavenworth. It premiered last Sunday, the 20th, on Starz. Here's the case file, made deceptively simple by Wikipedia, quote, Clint Allen Lawrence is a first lieutenant in the U.S. Army who, in August 2013, was found guilty on two counts of second-degree murder for ordering soldiers in his platoon to open fire at three men on a motorcycle in southern Afghanistan in July of 2012. He is confined in the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. End quote. Leavenworth, the series, a five-parter in weekly installments, is directed by Paul Pawlowski and Steven Soderbergh, and it tries to get at the various truths behind Lawrence's men's belief that he was guilty of murder, the relationship of Lawrence's sexuality to his fate, army policy and culture, and the conflicts between those things, and the adoption of Lawrence as a Fox News mascot. Jeb and I have only seen the first episode. I think that they throw a lot of balls into the air, and it sort of remains to be seen, A, whether they're going to be effectively juggled, because there's a lot going on here, and two, I am not entirely sure that they shouldn't have let some of the balls come down. By the time we get to the end of the first episode, we still are unclear on the exact outlines of this inciting incident. Like, it's barely been mentioned. So, Jeb, were you familiar at all with this case before you watched the first episode?
This happened in 2012 when I was at Gawker, and there was also a case of a U.S., I can't remember what branch of the service he was in, and I can't remember what his grade he was either, who was going out basically on hunting patrols and just executing Afghan citizens, like who he presumed deserved it. So there was this kind of welter of this going on. So I remember hearing about it, but not having it sink in.
And so is this around the time, not that Pat Tillman's death occurred, but that the materials covering Pat Tillman's death were coming out? I feel like it was around that time also.
I think that preceded it by maybe a year or two, because I know the degree of cover up was known, but like the fullness of it, like the full bloom of just how cynically Tillman had been used as a representative of like, yeah, you know, American voluntarism goodness, like that had started coming unraveled, but like the totality of it wasn't there. It wasn't like the, you know, the Private Jessica Lynch's rescue, "You Raise Me Up," you know, where like we had it and they had the TV movie. And I think within like 3 to 6 months, it was like, oh, actually every part of that story is nonsense.
Yeah. It's constructed. Yeah.
Yeah. But I did, I mean, like I read a little bit about this and like, you know, kind of to what you were saying about leaving so much up in the air, they do a little foreshadowing of some of the elements that are going to come. There's a village and the conditions in the village. The village is Saren's Eye is mentioned, but there's not enough there to kind of make you go, this is a detail I need to latch onto. So I don't know if they're going to come back and reiterate its value as like a location and a condition within this narrative. But yeah, like some of the groundwork that like anchors us in the event didn't seem to be as concrete as it could be. And instead we have this really sympathetic kind of social issues look at where Lawrence is coming from, which I don't mind, but it is so one-sided in this one that I wonder
I agree. I mean, it's extremely watchable and evocative, and I feel like you're getting a full hour of texture and that you are being given the ingredients that you need to put together the you know, main course later. That's the wrong metaphor, but here we all are. Let's move on. But I did wonder, part of me, like as a sort of reviewer professionally, is this decision to lay this much groundwork only questionable to me, or will civilians, as it were, find this, you know, like it moves right along. They get good tape, they get good talking head interviews, the access is fairly impressive. You know, I'm wondering if that's just me as a reviewer being a little impatient, but certainly I wished that there were more. One of the reviews I read, which I'll link in the show notes, said this might be a better binge property than to just watch it in weekly installments, partly for this reason. So I'm not sure how non-reviewers will find it, but it was very watchable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are pieces of information that we get that it's like, I'm not exactly sure how I'm supposed to feel about this yet. And I think that's intentional. Let me play clip two, which is talking about the motivation, Lawrence's motivation and the motivation of a lot of people, I think, to enlist.
The morning of 9/11, I was with Clint. Came on the radio, that first plane hit the towers, and Clint's blood just began to pool. I mean, he, right away, I had no idea what the Twin Towers were. By the end of the day, Clint was at the recruiting office.
He said, if I can make an ounce of difference, if I can make a change, if I can be a help to my country, that's what I want to do, serve my country.
Any thoughts on that clip?
Like other things that they bring up about his background, I want to see whether that contributes to maybe like a psychological alibi of certain things. And yes. But this one I felt could have been explored early, because by the time this happens, we are 11 years or like a solid decade into being in Afghanistan. We have abandoned by that point the discussions of maybe we should have gone in there and only targeted the members of Al-Qaeda and done small footprint special forces stuff. And it is interesting to me that they don't have him interrogating what he's doing, because he's going there to, you know, sort of, you know, vindicate America. But by that point too, you know, we found out that the entire predicate for the Iraq war is false. Like the last gasp of that is, I think in like 2008 or 2009, they found a cache of old like mustard gas shells.
Yeah,
that at this point were like so corroded they couldn't even detonate. But that, like, suddenly in 2008 or 2009, you had Ari Fleischer like just trying to fuck that chicken of like, oh, we found the WMDs. Like, so none of that bears out. And so he's part of what became the abandoned war. And we don't have him kind of questioning the value of it. Like, he gets into the service and then suddenly it's, well, the military is my peer group. The military gives me a structured sense of reward and acceptance. And like, I don't know, maybe they can re-examine that later, especially I'm imagining the fifth episode is going to be a lot of like contextual, like social and mental sort of alibi or stuff that maybe he didn't even accept as an alibi, but maybe we as a society can imagine is his alibi.
I think that this particular clip, although they don't really get in, they don't at all in the first episode get into this Fox News Hannity poster boy issue, but I think that what Clint actually said probably contained the word Arabs, and that this is a conveniently, I don't know exactly how to put this, I wrote the term self-serving take on his decision to enlist in our rundown syllabus, but I think that's perhaps unfair because I think a lot of people in static small communities are extremely motivated to enlist anyway, and that this has been true in peacetime as well, because it will get them out. It will give them vocational training. It will give them opportunities, and it will get them the fuck out of wherever they are.
And you do see some of that. I mean, he's overjoyed to be in South Korea, which, like, if you're in the army, you will wind up in South Korea.
Well, let's hear clip three.
And sure.
Yeah, because it's pertinent.
I've had several of the soldiers that served with him has told me that on the Army's birthday, that he bought a birthday cake for the Army. Now, that's dedication.
That's
nuts.
Dedication is what we're looking at here. Compulsion, maybe. Projection, sure.
I think if you did that at any job that was not a startup, of which you are like a founding officer, everybody would look at you like you were a fucking lunatic.
Well, like, oh my God.
If you came in on like, it's Wendy's birthday, like I know Dave Thomas isn't here to celebrate it, but I brought a cake for Wendy. Like, everybody would just be like, what are you doing?
Why are you doing that? Yeah, I just, and then they show a picture of it and it's like, all right, buddy. I mean, this is someone who was very happy to, and the woman we heard talking in both of those clips is his mom. And she's extremely proud of him and invested in his being misunderstood in the larger scenario, which, again, we haven't exactly heard what it is as of episode one. But this is also a conservative, like he grew up in what they call Texoma. This is a conservative person. This is a Pentecostal Christian, and this is a gay man who was like, don't ask, don't tell was still a thing. But we don't hear the clip I'm about to play until almost halfway through episode one. Here's clip four.
Clint still had that internal fight. His parents weren't exactly accepting of it. He had to worry about the military. He still had to hide certain aspects of his life.
I never asked to be gay. I don't really remember ever, you know, coming to realization. I just always kind of knew. And I remember it scared the crap out of me.
All right, the piano needs to maybe take it a little easy in the background there. What did you think of the decision to hold this until this far into the episode?
That didn't bug me as much as the fact that they didn't put it into the larger context of the military at the time. And I think maybe because it would undermine a little bit of the sense of like he needed to belong to the Army this hard, and it's the institution, because in a lot of cases it is, you know, it's your peers. So like, this is a kind of hobby horse of mine. I read a really good book, and back when I wrote book reviews for places, under different names. I read, I think it's Nathaniel Franks or Frank. I can't remember the last name. It's called Unfriendly Fire. It's basically the history of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. And I think it came out around about like 2009. But at that point, we had discharged something like 6,500 soldiers from the start of the war on terror. We had discharged 6,500 for homosexuality at the same time that we were loosening our standards for accepting volunteers, to the point that we were taking people with assault convictions, like felony assault.
Yeah, rapists.
Right. Who then had, took advantage of being like, you know, an agent of force in villages and places like Haditha. But that overall discussion, you know, and the disingenuous way of talking about it, the way that conservatives talk about it, is you talk about unit cohesion, like the unit has to look alike and it has to feel comfortable with each other. But if you think about like every movie you've ever seen about World War II, that's not how it works. It's task cohesion. Like you look at a World War II movie, there's like a Jew from New York, mm-hmm. there's an Irishman from Boston, there's a black guy from the South, there's like a Texan redneck, there's like a Midwestern farm kid, and they all are suspicious of each other. But when you get shot at, you have to depend on each other. And the task at hand effaces your differences. And that's what, you know, it's partly what Basic is about. It's like annihilate your sense of self, replace it with the sense of team,
sure.
and get past that ego. And so that process has already gone on. Like he's already been accepted by so much of the army and by individuals. So like if we're getting to the point and they're sort of foreshadowing that this guy's coming in as a platoon leader in green and might want to shoot some shit up to get accepted by his NCOs and his grunts, you're like, you know, he would have had an experience of like already being accepted in various milieu because he's been transferred. He's had different tasks within the army. And he's met different people along the way. He's been in different units.
Guy, and some of the guys from the platoon that they interview talk about the fact that, like, you know, usually when they have some sort of green, like, TAC ops guy who was at HQ transferred in, they're like, nah, but he had been an enlisted guy before he went to officer college, basically. The green to gold program, I guess it's called.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of, let's say, conflicts in army culture. And I think the show does a good job of showing how many of them there are and how many issues are in play here. But I sort of wished that they would pick more of a lane, at least up front. Like, giving us an overview is great, but these are like issues that go back generations sometimes, involving, you know, unit cohesion or like unit above command or army stated policy versus how things actually work with boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. There's the actual unjust prosecution of this war that they found themselves in. You know, there's the quagmire effect. There's his sexuality. There's, I mean, on and on and on. So I'm not sure that bringing them up, sort of like giving us this huge picture at the top, and then I presume zooming in on more on specifics, is the best way to do it in a weekly series or in something that's only 5 episodes. Like, you know, do you know how many documentaries there are about the decision to go into Iraq and Afghanistan? Like, there's many. It's a huge hydra of an issue, and I feel like every criminal case coming out of that theater involves all these issues, and I'm just not sure that a standard series is the best way into it. Let's hear clip 5, where this is where they zoom out to talk about what everyone's doing in at the scene of the crime in the first place.
The names of British regiments are carved in rock, perpetuating the memory of those who defended the Khyber Pass in the 3 Afghan wars.
I mean, it's called the Graveyard of Empires for a reason. Everybody who goes in fails.
We call it the Graveyard of Empires as though Afghanistan is winning, as though it's defeating these foreign governments. But the biggest price has always been paid by the Afghan people. Afghan civilians have faced generations of war. Children have grown up into full-fledged adults and never known peace in Afghanistan. And so Afghans feel forgotten. They feel like they've been made to pay the price that is the result of wars that other people had started.
I mostly pulled that clip because I thought that commentator, the way she put it, that she's like, it's not the graveyard of empires from any like proactive agency on the part of the Afghan people. It's just, you know, everyone's just trying to get in and out of the day alive. I thought that was well put. Good way to think about it. But again, this is a huge issue. Sorry, go ahead.
I think that's part two of what you're criticizing about their approach here. I mean, this sort of like shotgun blast of like each little pellet is a different like contextual factoid with which we could approach this whole thing. And, you know, like the start of Dexter Filkins's book, The Forever War, is actually pretty good about this, about underlining the fact that by the time we come in, we're already, if you're, you know, an Afghan citizen, you are in two decades of various warlords competing for, you know, like driving out the Soviets and then competing against the Taliban and trying to, you know, get some sort of security and stability. And then the United States comes and this perpetuates. And the reason why, you know, England, the reason why the Soviet Union, the reason why ultimately the United States are going to leave Afghanistan is not from lack of ability to pacify the country. It's from lack of willingness to do what you have to do to pacify a country like that, which is commit mass murder. I mean, like, if you can do it, but we don't have the stomach to do what works,
and we don't have it either. Exactly.
Or the other thing you can do, and this is actually something that's highlighted in what I think is, I mean, I want to see how this plays out, but just looking at the first episode, I think that Serial's second season, when they talked about Bo Bergdahl, does this quite a lot better, where they talk about, because there's a little bit in this where they're talking about the previous platoon leader and how well he led people out into the villages to hold a weekly shura and to figure out what locals needed and to win the hearts and minds. And Serial pointed out, like, very, you know, adroitly and very quickly, was that if you give somebody only a 1-year tour in a country, by the end of it, they might learn a bunch of Pashto, they might recognize some people, but then you remove them. And if you want to do it the hearts and minds, not the crushing and killing everyone way, you know, it's going to be more expensive. It's going to make you feel morally better, but it's going to take you 20 years and you need to leave people there.
Yeah.
And it almost has to become like a province of the United States in terms of, we just open up the purse and give them what they need and wait until it takes. And we're not going to do that. And so, like, that the Graveyard of Empires context, like, how does it inform what he thought he was doing? Like, what did he think the task was? Was it suppression, or was it, you know, was it like, you know, creating community ties? And how did he think he was going to foster that? And how did he think he was going to integrate with his unit by doing that? We know, because we've read the articles about it, that, like, he took the first option.
Yeah. Well, and I think I should say that, like, I am questioning or interrogating the approach here. But again, I will keep watching this. I am interested. Like, I was frustrated by where we were left at the end of the episode because I did want to know more and because I did feel that this setup was effective. And I'm just not sure that Starz is playing this quite right. Like, maybe they should have bundled the first two episodes together, because I just felt like I want more now. Like, this is extremely well done. I don't think they're reinventing any documentary wheels here, but they don't need to. There's good material here, and I think the way they're choosing to do the layout is considered. I don't think they don't know what they're doing. I was just frustrated as a viewer because I did want to learn more. Mm-hmm. And you know, then you have, like, Lawrence comes in, this guy, Dom Latino, is injured by an IED, he leaves. Lawrence comes in, and now you're starting to see all the threads come together, that he's new, He's an officer who has been more of a paper pusher, like, not really, but a little more. Like, the mental image you have is that the Mark Moses character in the movie Platoon, just like screaming into various crank phones ineptly or in vain, I guess. There's the issue of his sexuality, which makes him paranoid and very eager to establish himself, as well as his greenness as a combat officer. Mm-hmm. And there's this complete, I would say unhealthy, identification with the army as his source of self and self-worth.
Right.
Even though his basic nature is undesirable and illegal to it, to this organization.
Well, and although, you know, this is another thing they could explore. I hope they do. If they don't, I think this is actual, like, you know, this is malpractice. But before the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, whether you were in that much danger as an LGBT person in the armed services, I guess not T, right? But like, whether you were in danger of being booted out was almost always dependent on who your commander was, like your base commander, who, you know, if you were in the Navy, who your captain was or who your admiral was. And if they didn't give a shit, nobody gave a shit. If they gave a shit, lots of people gave a shit.
Right.
And he has the same brigade commander. He's there in, you know, doing intelligence prep and coordinating details on stuff like the village of Serenzai, right? Which we get the little teaser on. But like, he's got all the intel for this region. He's not leaving that command. So if the show tells us, yeah, his commander was a real, like, real fundamentalist, really intolerant of homosexual behavior, or like just homosexual people, period, in ranks, like, then that might inform his decision. But if his brigade commander is just like, well, whatever, then, you know, I don't consider that, you know, that's
but
not a compelling argument anymore.
But we still don't know who was aware, because we have to assume, like, they're in combat. He doesn't want to be, like, dishonorably discharged. And, like, I'm assuming that he was so deeply closeted that he was basically wood paneling.
That, so, or he's, you know, he comes from such a deeply fundamentalist background too, that, you know, that is a good cover. I mean, if you look at the people who did have to hide, you know, you're doing, if you come from a super religious background and you don't go out, like, to the brothel, or you don't go out to the club,
yeah,
that's a really good cover for why you're not doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe, you know, he might have been relatively fine, you know, in the eyes of his peers. Like, they either could figure it out and didn't care, or they didn't figure it out because they were willing to ascribe his, like, lack of amorousness around women to being like, well, that's just not how you do it, the way I was raised.
Yeah. Or again, they just didn't care for reasons of it not being something anyone should care about. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Cause in task cohesion, right? Like, if you got to go take a machine gun position and the person on, you know, covering your flank is a homosexual, you don't really care as long as they have bullets, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a variation of there's no atheists in the foxhole. Like,
right.
You know, like, are you really going to hold this line when someone is trying to lay down covering fire for you? I wouldn't, but what do I know?
Yes.
I live in Brooklyn.
As long as they shoot straight, it's fine.
Exactly. Exactly. But here's the last clip, which is towards the end of the first episode and gets more into the psychology of his actually, like, of, like, the management mindset, I guess, for lack of a better term.
So having a platoon have a sense of connection to each other, trust with each other, history with each other, deeply embraces the need for a sense of belonging. And that belonging, of course, is useful for the group to have cohesion and work together, but it's also a challenge to anyone entering the group who hasn't been a part of the history.
When I met with the soldiers, I knew that I was meeting with people who had seen a lot more combat than I had. And so I was a little bit intimidated by them, but I could never let them know that.
Maybe he just felt like he didn't have the credibility as a battle-tested leader. But it was an issue that he brought up with the NCOs, that he felt like not having a combat badge made people view him differently.
Okay, if this is the part in the prison movie, if you'll excuse this particular reference, where you're going to take a chair and break it over the biggest guy's head in the room, don't announce that you feel that you have to do that because you don't have any combat experience and you're gay. Just take the chair and start swinging is right. A. But B, that goes back to what you were saying about the hearts and minds thing sort of on a more micro scale within the unit. That it's like everyone within this group of soldiers also has to win each other's hearts and minds so that they can function effectively is the idea, I guess. So that's operating on two levels or isn't operating.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like a tale as old as time for the military, even the American military, yeah. You know, like the founding of the army, the Continental Army, they had, you know, one to like, I can't remember how many year enlistments. And then they trained, like everybody would just go home. It was like, oh, well, I had enough. Like, well, so let somebody else fight for independence. And the idea of like having to deal with replacement commanders who hadn't been at Valley, you know, this guy wasn't at Valley Forge. Or, you know, this asshole wasn't at Bastogne and now he's going to be the one to take us into Germany. You know, fuck him.
Yeah. And well, as somebody who has Civil War all the time, that it was like, well, it's Christmas. See ya.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
and then they would walk home to like Maine from Gettysburg. Like, all right. Good luck. Yeah, but, I wouldn't come back if I were you, but some of them did. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
They had more walking practice back
then.
They
sure did.
So, but like, you know, as somebody who has this institutional love for the army, you know, you would hope maybe, and maybe he doesn't, like maybe he just didn't do his research, you know, maybe he didn't read like histories of the army or, maybe he didn't watch Band of Brothers and see the episode Replacements. It's even titled Replacements. So you know what it's about, right? But like maybe he didn't see that and he didn't know. But you would hope like somebody who has this institutional love for it would know that this is like a perennial problem. Every war experiences it again. And every war has people who solve the problem the wrong way, which is getting in and going, you know what? These guys aren't going to take me seriously until I'm blooded. Let's go do something extremely violent or psychotic or dangerous.
Well, every institution has this problem.
Right.
Too.
Yeah.
It's just not as like there's not like a literal flashpoint to illustrate the figurative flashpoint. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm gonna keep watching this. Are you gonna keep going?
Yeah, I think I'll keep going. It's interesting. Like you said, they put so many balls up in the air. You know, you have that scattershot shotgun blast. I want to see what comes back and is relevant. I want to see if the ambience of this ultimately led to like each episode maybe unpacking an aspect from it. There are little things that like, you know, we see and we didn't see again. Like we mentioned that he wanted to enlist at like 17. His parents said no, but he was doing military PT in preparation at the same time as he was in like a police academy or training to be in a police academy. And so maybe, you know, maybe this is somebody who just however much he might have been, he might have felt stigmatized for his sexuality or however much he might not have felt like he belonged in his family as a full participating member. He also might have had a pathology where he was just really interested in jobs that have a punitive and armed, you know, like aspect to them, right? Like maybe
that
he
are
was
extremely
just
regimented and that you can prove yourself by moving up in literal rank. It is appealing to some people's sense of order and approbation.
Right, or the tale of like how we assimilate different ethnicities into the concepts of whiteness and like the concepts of the sort of hegemonic culture of the United States, right? Like the Irish are a bestialized, filthy people. Well, they become police, and then we start to respect them because they become the armed wing of capital preserving order. Like maybe this is a guy who on like some fundamental level was like, I will be accepted if I can get in a position where I keep down the people who are worse than me, right?
Yeah.
So I'll be a cop, but until I can get into the military or
and
vice versa.
And also that I can model this like hyper straightness.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, also one other note, and this just appeals, I think, only to you, maybe to your listeners, but just because one of the ones we did was on Leah Remini's Leah Remini's After Scientology program.
Yes.
Petraeus kind of looks like this weird cross between Wayne LaPierre and David Miscavige.
Yeah, he does.
In this?
It's the hairline,
I saw him.
I
was like, that's what he looks like now? Yeah, I'll figure it out, but like eventually. But he does have that really weirdly like kind of wide cheekbones and then very pointedly narrowing jaw, but it's not like jutting out. And I was like, that's the little Miscavige. The hair is the little LaPierre vibe, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny to see these guys out of uniform. Like, there is a certain pattern recognition to figures that we are used to associating with uniform that makes me think that if I saw Colin Powell just, like, out buying groceries, that I would not recognize him. I'd just be like, oh, that guy looks like Colin Powell. This has happened to me with my own grandfather. We're, like, looking at old pictures, and I'm like, who's that guy? And my cousin's like, are you fucking kidding? And I'm like, no, he died when I was two. She's like, who else would it be? There's a Christmas tree in the background. You think it's some guy? I'm like, I don't know. He didn't have the greens on. I don't know.
My God, it's David Petraeus.
I know. Like he's.
What did he get me?
How is David Miscavige at Christmas 1964? And that shirt. Oof. All right. Well, I think that's about it. On Leavenworth, but again, that's airing Sundays on Stars. And if you guys have been watching and are going to keep watching or aren't, let us know what you think. That's Blotter Presents across all social media. Moving on to the cold case section. There's a bunch of meanings to cold here, but this is a pretty cold case. We are talking about criminals October 20th, 2017. Episode The Escape. Here's the case file, although I doubt either portion of this cold case topic really needs an introduction, but here we go. On the night of June 11th, 1962, three men escaped from Alcatraz Prison in San Francisco Bay. Frank Morris and John and Clarence Anglin had a careful, elaborate plan, pieces of which washed up on various local shores in the following days, but it's still unknown whether they survived the bay's icy waters, and if so, whether they're alive today. The Anglin sister Marie believes they did and are, or she did as of 2017 when Phoebe Judge and her team interviewed her, and the marshal stuck with this iciest of cases, Mike Dyke, for an episode of the Criminal Podcast. I think you're fairly familiar with the Alcatraz tour, Jeb, is that correct?
Yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I went to multiple different school districts because my parents kept moving a lot. And so, you know, one school district would have the Alcatraz field trip in third grade, and then another one would have it in fourth grade. So I think I did it like 4 years in a row, in addition to it being one of those things where, you know,
by
your family's
school,
in from out of
like
town.
A docent. Amazing.
Yeah. No, actually, yeah, like the last time I was there when I was a kid, I was sitting there like just, you know, we were in the back and we couldn't hear things well. And I think my aunt was like, what is he saying? And I was just like, oh, well, he said this, but he'll get to this later. But you might want to know, because, yeah, I just like a total Alcatraz dork, which I think is pretty common if you grew up in the Bay Area and you're a boy. Like, that's where Al Capone was.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Had you listened to any episodes of Criminal prior to this? Are you a fan? Agnostic?
No, I hadn't. I did like the fact that she spoke in the very kind of like very measured podcast way that let me hit the 1.5 speed button.
Uh-huh.
I always like it when people don't talk as rapidly as I do, and it's still really understandable when you're on that. And so, but I did like it. I mean, some of the cadence and the delivery was like, this is very podcasty. But
well,
I enjoyed the fact that she had...
It, honestly, she's been doing this for a real long time. I think this was like the second podcast I listened to where I didn't know the people personally. But I've always appreciated, like, she does one a month. They're half an hour. That's it. And it's not all fucking Bundy. So God bless Phoebe Judge.
And she did her work. It's nice to hear these when there's some journalism involved, even if it's just finding the principals and getting them on the phone and getting them to talk a little bit about it, as opposed to picking over the work of others, because you will find like a shade or a tone that maybe you didn't get from the material itself that that can be enlightening hearing it from, you know, from first person sources like that. To me, I'm always like, good job. Thank you for that work.
Yeah, it does have a flavor to it. As I so often think in these cases of recidivist escape dudes, and it's usually dudes, that I'm like, if you just were able to like stay out and then apply this level of thorough preparation and determination to straight work, you'd be fine. Start with forging IDs and then you can work from there. But here's a, here's clip seven in which they talk about how, the Anglins at least wound up in Alcatraz, and it's because of all the escaping that they'd been doing before.
All three brothers were arrested for bank robbery and sent to prison in Atlanta. But John and Clarence kept trying to escape and were eventually transferred to Leavenworth, Kansas. In 1960, Clarence tried to help John smuggle himself out of Leavenworth in a big bread box. That was the last straw. John was sent to Alcatraz. Clarence joined him 3 months later after a letter smuggling incident.
I mean, I just love everything about that. Like, what kind of bread were y'all eating back at the turn of the 60s, first of all? Like, that is a huge fucking bread box. Second of all, the choice to just say a letter smuggling incident and not elaborate is like, yes, perfect. Perfect. Perfect detail, and then I can go look it up on my own if I'd like to. So good.
I can't imagine being the guard that busted that escape attempt, and just like, how many is it bigger than a bread box jokes can you get out
before yes.
the guy's taken to the hole? I mean, just
yeah, or like he's being carried away and you're like, oh wait, bring it back here, and then you're like, you're toast, okay, take him away again.
Yeah, this is the greatest thing since sliced inmate.
Oh yeah, there it is. I mean, I just love, this is one of the reasons that I love escape stories like this, is the detail, like how it was planned, how long it took, who had to know what, just the level of detail that, again, part of it is like, well, why didn't you just apply this to like starting your own business? But I guess this is their business. So, some of them that they're like, look, I can't, these skills don't translate. I can get you out of any prison, but these skills are no good for anything else. So that is appealing to me. And there's also good detail from the law enforcement side in clip eight.
He says the U.S. Marshals Service will keep going after a fugitive no matter what, until they turn 99 years old. Then, the marshals back off. If you've made it that far, well, I guess you get a pass.
Well, yeah. I never knew that, though. Like, I do like that, even when it's a case that I am familiar with, that she finds something that I don't know, or gives me something to think about that I hadn't thought about before.
Similarly, I liked the details that she included about the means of their escape, like the rafts that they had built out of old rain slickers, or not old, but just rain slickers that the other inmates had procured for them. Like, I don't believe that was a detail that was included in the tours when I was a kid. Very much like, you know, you ask, like, has anybody escaped? And they tell you, you know, all the escape attempts, and you say, what happened to them? And they're like, yeah, I probably drowned. And that's a really, I mean, I know it's not like an attempt at propaganda, like the Park Service isn't there trying to like get cred for Alcatraz's inescapability.
Yeah.
You know, that's not, they don't work for the Bureau of Prisons. They work for the National Park Service. They don't care. They're not covering the beat. But that's a really easy sell if you've just come over on the ferry from Alcatraz.
Yeah,
Or from San Francisco, because the water is brutal. I mean, it's so cold on the island too. You know, like, you don't have to imagine that how cold the water was going to be or how strong the current is, because you've just come through it and you're there and it's the middle of July and it's like 51 degrees.
Yeah, exactly. I've been on the tour once or twice. It is like legitimately creepy there. The dummy heads are, it's not an uncanny valley thing. There's just something very, it's closer to the Genesis video for Land of Confusion level of creepy. But I don't think
spinning image.
Sorry, what's that?
It was a British show. Spitting Image was a British satirical show. They got the puppet heads from there.
Yeah. And I think it's being, is that being rebooted? I feel like I just read something about that. I did not know that they, I think I knew they had saved hair for some various like realism things, but they like made eyelashes. Like these heads really don't look like human heads, but that they put eyelashes on made of hair that they saved. It's really, now that is dedication, in my opinion, much more than a cake that you make for the army that you bake file into, probably.
The heads kind of look like the head that Starling finds at Hester Moffat's garage when Lecter sends her out there, and there's the hearse and all the...
Yes. Ooh. Yes.
It just kind of looks like that.
And there's one, there was like a fourth guy and he didn't make it. Mills? Is that his name?
Alan West, I think, is his name.
That's right.
Which is, I do have a callback to that. At the end, but
so there are four heads that you see in various like pictures and displays. They'll be in the visual aids, and one of them is like this extremely truncated, sort of like from the ears forward only. It's just very, it's creepy. But I was happy to re-engage with this story. This was like just enough processy detail for me. I did disappear down a like Google hole for a little while afterwards, and then I came up, I felt refreshed, and now I can move on. But I'd like to play our last clip and then ask you what you think happened.
Well, I think they made it.
Good for you.
What do you think?
What makes you think that?
Well, you've just told me about a wonderful plan that they were able to execute there. I mean, I don't know. I mean, why wouldn't they have made it? It sounds fantastic, the whole thing.
Once they went in the water, obviously nobody knows what happened. No bodies were ever recovered. But also on the same note, there's been no positive proof that any of them lived, so...
I mean, I just love that Phoebe Judge in her heart feels like the universe cares how hard they worked on this.
Yeah.
That it's like, no, this isn't a science fair. The way that it was supposed to work is not pertinent. But I mean, I also have compassion for like, well, it kind of like, we want them to have escaped for whatever reasons. Do you think they made it?
When I was a kid, I would have said absolutely not. But since reading about this, because, you know, like you said, dip down a Google hole, and looking at all the different sort of investigations that have gone on since and different theories, I think the big kind of crux for that is I don't know if they know exactly how the tides were performing that night. I mean, supposedly some people can make a model. And like, if you've never visited San Francisco and you've never like seen the bay, or you've never known anybody who's gone out on it, you won't really understand just how savage the riptides are. Like, that's one of the things that happens, like people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, if they make it, like, you know, if they survive, like they just get ripped out to the Pacific Ocean, like and they can't fight against it, and it's just hopeless business. So,
and I believe early in this podcast's life there was a like Smithsonian Channel miniseries featuring some of the Anglin nephews talking about this, and they had a whole tidal chart. I remember not thinking terribly highly of that project, but certainly tide nerds, A, are a thing. You're welcome, everyone. Mm-hmm. And B, have a lot of thoughts about what is and is not possible. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
But, you know, I think as a kid, I just always assumed that whatever, like, flotation aids they had would have failed. And then, you know, in the podcast, we get this moment where they're talking about putting a weight on these makeshift life preservers that they had. So they had not life preservers, but, like, life jackets. So they had life jackets in addition to a kind of, like, rubber boat that they made out of these raincoats. And... if they'd just gone in the water and were trying to swim for it, like, no, I don't think so.
No.
Just because of the sheer temperature, it's like getting stabbed by a frozen knife if you jump into it. It's just that cold. But with that, like with an aid, there are so many different ways they could have gone. I really feel like, you know, like it's completely reasonable to go, yeah, I think they made it.
Yeah, I think that, I think it's possible. I think that there is like some evidence that if you want to believe it, suggests that they lived. I think that this is an, you know, another D.B. Cooper thing where they'd be in their mid to late 80s now, and even if they did survive that, you know, surviving under an assumed identity in Brazil, like if that's what happened, they're probably dead now. But yeah. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. I do think that there's a whole segment where they're talking about deaths in the family, and that allegedly the brothers were there and were in drag or in disguise or showed up at the funeral home before everybody else did. And I just feel like this is where escape, like people who are close with their families, when the family's like, I'm sure that, you know, they escaped and that they were here and we found this sign, blah, 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 that this is where it tends to fall apart. Because I think for the most part, people can't resist letting themselves be known at least once. And the family says they have evidence to that effect, like blank letters with various postmarks and stuff like that. But I don't think that at some point in the 80s, they wouldn't have finally been like, well, probably no one cares about this anymore, and tried to show up again. And they never have, so.
Or just gone to a country that doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States. I mean, if you can go anywhere, if you've saved up cash and you could go anywhere, you could go and then send a letter or make a phone call and then have nothing happen.
Yeah.
The drag appearance at the funeral thing, that stretched credibility for me, but that was apparently like the eyewitness statement to that was like a family friend and not them.
Yeah.
So that to me could just be like wishful thinking. But the other stuff, like cumulatively, seems interesting enough and, you know, not necessarily, you know, constitutes proof, but there's enough going on there that, and also, I don't think that this family could have monetized speculation about this very well. Like, I don't know why you would keep up the gimmick. I mean, they're not dining out on this. Like, yeah. Maybe they get like 500 or 1500 bucks to do an interview, but like, you know, you'd probably get that anyway. Cause like, so even if you said like, I don't think they made it, somebody's still going to come interview you on another anniversary and you can still get like another 500 bucks if you need it.
Yeah. And there's no, I mean, they started stonewalling the FBI from the get, and there was no consequences to that as far as I know. So You may as well, like if the History Channel shows up and is like, here's a few grand, can you go over it again? Since you are still alive. Sure. I'll do that. Anyway, I'm almost never not going to recommend an episode of Criminal. Again, it's only half an hour of your time. It's self-contained. This was as predictably satisfying and excellent as usual. And again, that's, I think, episode 77. It aired 2 years ago, and it's called The Escape. Because there's really only the one.
Yeah.
Still can't find that one. Siren side effect, so...
In local news today, bees.
Because bees. Jeb, where else can listeners find you?
Well, you can find me at my podcast, Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean, in which myself and David J. Roth, an editor for Deadspin, watch Hallmark original movies and try to treat them with respect while being hopefully funny and critical. You can also listen to your lovely host, Sarah D. Bunting, on, what is it? It is episode 62, Love in Paradise was the movie, the last Hallmark film starring Luke Perry. The episode is entitled The Piglet Level is Just Rising.
It really was rising, but just to the right level, I felt.
It really wasn't like the floodwaters of piglets.
Usually when I'm a guest on your podcast, I am extremely mean, but I wasn't that mean to that. It was cute. It's a cute movie.
You had fun. I enjoyed the experience of having you go, you know what, I liked this.
Yeah.
After like three episodes of you going, absolutely not.
Well, I mean, after the baton death march that is the Wedding March franchise, will they ever get married? Reader, no, they won't.
Yeah. the Jack Wagner ring cycle.
it really is. Jack Wag-Nickleby? I don't even know. There is a wedding March 4, but until then, and until our next episode, if you have a tip for the Blotter Presents, please find me on social media. Like I said, Blotter Presents everywhere. And at Eve Beatty's and my True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. If we have 2,000 paid subscribers, that means we'll cover the Theranos trial in San Francisco in person. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. Excuse me, Apple Podcasts. Or wherever you get your podcasts, so that other listeners can find us. My guest has been Jeb Lund, and he is on Twitter at Mobute. I am Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.